I didn't realize the air in the office was that thin until I tried to breathe after the door clicked shut. It was a soft sound, the kind a well-oiled glass door makes when it seals you out of a room you were supposed to be leading. Across the open-plan floor, the midday sun was hitting the rows of dual monitors, turning the desks into a sea of white light that felt blindingly indifferent. I stood there, clutching a leather-bound notebook I'd filled with 3 years of strategy, and watched the silhouette of a man named Marcus through the frosted glass. He wasn't even sitting in the chair yet. He was leaning against the mahogany desk, laughing at something the CEO had said, looking like a man who had just inherited a kingdom he hadn't spent a single day building. I had hit 150% of my quota for 4 consecutive quarters. I was the person people called when a Tier 1 account was ready to churn. I was the one who stayed until 9 p.m., rewriting the integration playbooks, because the sales team had overpromised on features that didn't exist yet. But in that moment, as the laughter muffled through the glass, I realized that in the language of the C-suite, hard work is just a utility, like electricity or high-speed internet. It's expected to be there. It's necessary for the lights to stay on. But nobody ever invites the power lines to sit at the table. In the bottom drawer of my desk, tucked under a stack of old quarterly business reviews, there is a small silver thumb drive. It's a hidden object, something I've carried with me through 3 different office moves. It contains the raw data from a project I ran 2 years ago, a side hustle internal audit I did on my own time to prove that our churn rate was being driven by a lack of diverse account management styles. I never showed it to anyone. I told myself I was saving it for the right moment, a piece of leverage to show I was thinking 3 levels above my pay grade. I kept it like a talisman, a secret proof of my own value that I was too afraid to test in the open air. Now the weight of it in the drawer felt like a lead weight. I had spent 2 years protecting the company's reputation by fixing their messes in silence, thinking that my silence was a form of professionalism. I thought if I didn't complain, if I just outworked the bias, it would eventually become invisible. I was wrong. Silence doesn't make bias go away. It just gives it a quiet place to grow. The smell of the office is always the same. Expensive coffee beans and the faint ozone scent of 100 running laptops. It's a clean smell, a productive smell. But that afternoon it felt clinical, like a hospital wing. I walked back to my desk, my heels clicking on the polished concrete floors of our Austin headquarters. Every click felt like a countdown. I sat down and looked at my monitor. An email from the CEO was already sitting at the top of my inbox. It was addressed to the whole company. It used words like vision and alignment and culture fit. It announced Marcus as the new VP of client success. Marcus, who had been with the company for 18 months. Marcus, who I had trained on our core product architecture during his 2nd week. Marcus, who had missed his numbers twice in the last year, but played golf with the board members on Sunday mornings. I stared at the word culture until it stopped looking like a word and started looking like a fence. I remember the first time I felt the shift in the room, about 6 months ago. We were in a strategy session for the Q3 roadmap. I had prepared a 40-slide deck on how to transition our legacy clients to the new SaaS model without losing the high-touch feel they liked. I started to speak, and I watched the CEO's eyes drift to his phone. 2 minutes in, Marcus interrupted. He didn't have a deck. He just leaned back, put his hands behind his head, and said that we needed to be more aggressive, more disruptor-minded. He used a lot of sports metaphors. The CEO looked up, nodded, and said, "I like that energy, Marcus. Expand on that." For the next 20 minutes, Marcus rephrased the points I had already made, but he said them louder and with more certainty. I sat there and watched my own ideas being laundered through his voice. I didn't say anything. I told myself it didn't matter who got the credit, as long as the work got done. That was the first lie I told myself. The second lie was that the people in that room didn't notice what was happening. They noticed. They just preferred the way the ideas sounded when they came from someone who looked like them. The ticking of the wall clock in the break room always seems louder when the office goes quiet for lunch. I stood by the espresso machine, watching the dark liquid fill the cup, feeling the heat radiate against my palm. A junior account manager, a girl named Sarah, who I'd been mentoring, came in and stood next to me. She looked at the floor and said she was sorry about the announcement. She said it didn't make sense. I looked at her, and for a second, I wanted to tell her the truth. I wanted to tell her that the game is rigged, that the ladder has a broken rung specifically designed for people like us. But instead, I just smiled a tight professional smile and said that Marcus had a lot of great energy. I could feel the shame of that lie in my throat. I was protecting a system that was currently crushing me, and I was doing it in front of a woman who looked up to me. I was teaching her how to be a victim with a smile. I spent the next 3 days in a state of hyper-analytical numbness. I went through every meeting invite from the last quarter, every Slack thread, every project post-mortem. I was looking for the gatekeeper. I knew the CEO liked me well enough, or at least he liked the revenue I brought in. But someone in that final closed-door session had vetoed my name. Someone had said the words that turned my performance into a liability. Maybe they said I was too tactical. Maybe they said I lacked the executive presence. Those are the words they use when they can't find a fault in the data. Executive presence is the ghost in the machine. You either have it or you don't. And conveniently, it's usually defined by the traits of the person doing the defining. I felt like a detective at the scene of my own professional murder, looking for a fingerprint on a glass door. The fluorescent lights in the stairwell have a specific high-pitched hum that you only notice when you're leaning against the cold brick wall, trying to keep your heart rate down. I had just come out of a one-on-one with my direct supervisor, a man who had always been a neutral ally. I asked him point blank why I wasn't considered. He looked everywhere but at my face. He talked about the long-term trajectory of the company. He mentioned that Marcus had a certain charisma that was needed for the VP level. Then he said the sentence that I will never forget. "We just feel like you're so valuable where you are right now. We can't afford to move you." They had turned my excellence into a cage. I was too good at the work to be allowed to lead it. I was the engine, and you don't move the engine to the driver's seat, because then the car won't run. It was the most honest thing he had ever said to me, and it was the most insulting. I went back to that silver thumb drive. I plugged it in and looked at the files. I had spent so much time being the fix-it girl, the one who smoothed over the rough edges of the male ego in the office, that I had forgotten I had a life outside of those four walls. I realized I was trying to protect a reputation that was already being used against me. They saw me as reliable, which is just another word for stagnant in their eyes. They didn't fear losing me because I had never given them a reason to. I had been so loyal that I had become a fixture, like the ergonomic chairs or the free snacks in the kitchen. You don't promote a fixture. You just use it until it breaks. The sound of rain hitting the large windows of the Austin office is a low, rhythmic thrum. It started around 4 p.m. on a Tuesday, the day I decided to stop being a utility. I had an old contact at our biggest competitor, a firm based in Denver, that had been trying to poach me for a year. I had always turned them down out of a misplaced sense of integrity. I called him from my car in the parking garage. We talked for 40 minutes. He didn't ask me about my energy or my charisma. He asked me about my retention numbers. He asked me about the architecture of the integration playbook I had written. He offered me a director of operations role on the spot, with a clear path to VP in 12 months, and a salary that made my current pay look like an allowance. I sat in the dark of my car, the windows fogging up, and I didn't feel happy. I felt a cold, sharp clarity. I had been waiting for a seat at a table that was never built for me, while there was an entire forest outside where I could build my own. I didn't quit the next day. I waited. I wanted to see the gatekeepers in action one more time. We had a leadership alignment meeting. Marcus was at the head of the table, struggling to explain the Q4 forecast. He kept tripping over the churn variables. The CEO looked frustrated. He looked at me. He expected me to jump in. He expected me to save the meeting, to provide the data that would make Marcus look like a leader. It was a familiar dance. I would provide the facts. Marcus would provide the energy, and the company would move forward. The room went silent. Everyone turned to me. I could feel the pressure, the collective weight of their expectation that I would do what I always did. I would be the bridge. I looked at Marcus, then at the CEO. I took a slow sip of my water. I felt the coldness of the glass against my lip. I put the glass down and said, "That's an interesting challenge, Marcus. I'm sure you'll find a way to align that with the vision you mentioned earlier." Then I closed my notebook. The silence that followed was different than the silence after the promotion announcement. This silence was heavy. It was the sound of an engine failing. I watched the CEO's face shift from expectation to confusion to a sudden flickering realization. He saw the bridge collapse in real time. He saw that the person who held the floor together had just stepped off it. It was the first time in 3 years I felt like I had more power than anyone else in that room, and I hadn't said a single aggressive word. I walked out of that meeting and went to a small coffee shop 3 blocks away. I needed to see people who didn't know who Marcus was. I sat at a small wooden table, the surface scratched and worn, and I wrote my resignation letter. I didn't make it emotional. I didn't mention the promotion. I didn't mention the glass door. I just stated my final date and thanked them for the opportunity. I knew that the moment I handed it in, the gaslighting would start. They would tell me I was being impulsive. They would offer me a small raise, a title change that meant nothing, a promise of next time. They would try to convince me that I was the problem, that I hadn't communicated my goals clearly enough. But I had the data now. Not just the data on the thumb drive, but the data of their behavior. One practical consequence of speaking up is that you lose the comfort of the lie. You can no longer pretend that the world is a meritocracy. You have to live with the knowledge that people will look you in the eye and lie to you about your own value. But the consequence of staying silent is much worse. If you stay silent, you eventually start to believe the lie yourself. You start to think that maybe you really do lack that invisible presence. You start to shrink to fit the space they've carved out for you. I looked at my reflection in the window of the coffee shop. I looked tired, but I didn't look defeated. I looked like someone who had just stopped trying to solve a puzzle that was missing half its pieces. The last thing I had to do was find out who the veto was. I didn't need it for my career, but I needed it for my soul. I caught the HR director in the hallway on my way out for the day. She was a woman who had seen it all, a veteran of a dozen tech cycles. I asked her, off the record, if there was a specific concern that kept me out of the VP role. She looked around, then leaned in close. She smelled like peppermint tea. She said, "It wasn't about your work, Diane. Someone in the room said you were too vital to the day-to-day. They said if we promoted you, the department would fall apart within a month." And the others agreed. It was the ultimate trap. I had worked so hard to make myself indispensable that I had made myself unpromotable. My excellence was their insurance policy, and they weren't going to let me cash it in. I went home and packed my desk. I didn't wait for my final 2 weeks. I had enough vacation time saved up to cover the gap. I put the thumb drive in my pocket. I left the leather-bound notebook on the desk, empty of any new strategies. The office was quiet, the cleaning crew moving between the desks with their vacuum cleaners, the sound a dull roar in the background. I walked past the frosted glass door of the VP office. Marcus's name wasn't on it yet, just a blank plastic holder waiting for a slip of paper. I realized I didn't hate Marcus. Marcus was just a symptom. I hated the room that thought Marcus was the answer. The air outside was humid, the Austin heat finally breaking into a cool evening breeze. I stood by my car and looked up at the glass building. It looked beautiful from the outside, all glowing lights and modern angles. It looked like a place where big things happened, and they did. But they happened on the backs of people who were never meant to see the view from the top. I got into my car and started the engine. The dashboard lit up, a familiar glow. I had the offer from Denver sitting on my passenger seat. I had my data. I had my reputation. And for the first time in years, I had my own silence back. Not the silence of protection, but the silence of a clean break. When I finally handed in my notice, the CEO called me into his office. He looked panicked. He offered me a 20% raise on the spot. He told me he was planning on creating a new senior VP role just for me in 6 months. He used all the words he thought I wanted to hear. I listened to him, and I realized he wasn't talking to me. He was talking to the engine. He was trying to keep the lights on. I let him finish, and then I told him the offer I had accepted. I told him the title. I watched the color drain from his face as he realized that the person he thought he owned had just priced herself out of his market. He asked me if there was anything he could do to make me stay. I looked at the glass door, then back at him. I said, "No. You already told me everything I needed to know." I drove away from that building, and I didn't look back. I thought about Sarah, the junior account manager. I had sent her a private email before I left. I didn't give her a lecture. I just gave her the name of a recruiter, and and a copy of the audit I had done 2 years ago. I told her to keep her own data. I told her that her hard work was a currency, and she should be very careful where she spent it. It wasn't a happy ending, not in the way they show in the movies. I was leaving my home of 3 years. I was moving to a new city. I was starting over. But as I hit the highway, the speedometer climbing, I felt a lightness in my chest that I hadn't felt since I started that job. The gatekeepers are always there. They are in the meetings you aren't invited to. They are in the golf games you don't play. They are in the language of culture, fit, and executive presence. They are real, and they are powerful. But they only have power as long as you agree to play by their rules. The moment you realize that your value isn't something they grant you, but something you carry with you, the gatekeepers become nothing more than men in a room, laughing behind a glass door that you no longer want to open. I rolled down my window and let the Texas wind fill the car. I wasn't the fix-it girl anymore. I was just a woman who knew exactly what she was worth. And for the first time, that was enough.